You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
It'll be kind of like being a pilot. You'll come out of college and you want a cyber guarantee. And we'll give you a cyber guarantee.
Great.
And then if you make it through the school, then you'll get qualified and that's what you'll go do. If you don't, then we'll
room in the garage.
Make you an infantry officer.
Worked okay for you and
worked
me.
Out for so. You. Of course, everyone knows that the most intelligent, handsome people on the earth are infantry officers.
As this would convey.
Exhibit A and B.
That's right.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me.
Everybody knows that, right? Even our next guest joining us, Alex Hollings. Do you want to verify that? The most intelligent and best-looking officers in the Marine Corps are infantry officers? Go ahead. Say it.
The best-looking. I mean, seeing as they're almost all men, I'd argue that I'd probably lean towards, like, admin or, you know, even food service for better-looking.
You know what? It was.
But yeah, maybe I'll give you intelligent.
It was amazing to me when I saw I got four slot moved into supply when I augmented in the Marine Corps. I ultimately got out of it and back to the infantry, but I went to, and so I'd been, as an infantry lieutenant, I'd been around the infantry in my life, and you don't realize how broke and rode hard everybody is, and then you go to, like, a community that was worried about barcodes and supply modernization, they PT at lunch every day, they eat right, and they're young and, you know, and fit and they don't look broke. Their hands aren't permanently formed into a holder for a cup of coffee and a cigarette. And you look and you're like, who are these people? I don't know a master sergeant that looks like that. He looks like a sergeant, for God's sakes. I don't know any infantry guys that look like that. And so it was quite the eye opener.
It's funny that you say that, because when I played football in the Marine Corps, I played for Headquarters Battalion at 29 Palms. And we destroyed every victory unit on the base for two reasons. Number one, because we had these, like, gunnies who had done nothing but less for 20 years. But then we could recruit guys from just employees of the base. So we had just the moment dudes that were, you know, box kickers, the civilian employees. So our Headquarters Battalion team was stacked.
It's amazing, though. They looked all younger and fit, and I was like, "Wow, that road." The whole what's that phrase? Road hard, put away wet. Pretty amazing. Let me ask you. I want to talk old man fitness. I want to get an old man fitness update. But before we do, I want to get your reaction to this story as somebody who tells stories. I was perusing the news as I do, and I noticed that there was this a court martial for the officer of the deck for the USS Fitzgerald last week and the week prior, I think, and that she entered into a plea agreement. In reading the article, I found out that this was the second time she had been tried for the same offense. She had been previously the NJP'd her. And then they had this consolidated convening authority that's going to oversee justice in both the Fitzgerald and the McCain. And they decided, yeah, you can't NJP somebody when seven people have been killed. Okay? That's not right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I just want to ask you, so I explain this, what's going to happen, and I tell you, yeah, she's going to get NJP'd for an incident that involves her negligence, and seven sailors were killed. Okay, are you all right with that? And what would you say?
Absolutely not.
How in God's name did anybody think that that's the appropriate for, you know?
NJP is an appropriate punishment if you get caught underage drinking in the base theater. An NJP is an appropriate punishment for a DUI because you're going to be facing civilian charges. that NJP is not an appropriate punishment for people losing their lives. You know, I'm getting a lot of interference. Is it all coming from my fault?
Yes.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. You're in hillbilly country. You know, the fact that we can simply talk to you is always a good thing. That means the soup.
This is a brand new phone, so I assume it's the phone.
That means it's, you know, when the soup can and the string are all working in a reasonable fashion, then we're okay with that, man. We're okay with that. I mean, I was stunned. I thought, okay, so look, it's not bad enough, the leadership issues that you all have faced in front of God and everybody. But somebody doubles down on that in terms of thinking that this is the appropriate way to handle it. I was just, honestly, Alex, I read that. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And so if you're a civilian listening, it's the equivalent of you doing something that kills 7 people and being charged with some type of misdemeanor. And then,
and I'm inclined to even say it's not even that serious. You know, I mean, the corporate equivalent of an NJP would be if you got in a lot of trouble at work, you got, you know, a formal reprimand and maybe a reduction in your pay grade, you know, your pay scale.
Right.
That's really all it is. It's not even that permanent. You know, you'll see a reduction, but you'll still be, you know, promotable within 18 months. You may see a reduction in your pay for 90 days. You know, an NJP is a slap on the wrist. That's why it's non-judicial. You know, that's the premise.
Yeah, I was stunned. I was stunned, and I just thought, like, wow. You know, when you do these things, it's like, first thing is, let's not make it worse. Let's make sure we get this right. And so I was reading kind of the whole formulation of the Consolidated Convening Authority, and I thought, well, this is exactly why you do that. Because you start looking now, this officer, she was the officer of the deck. She was driving, literally. She was the one in charge of driving the ship that night. And it's just stunning to me that we're ultimately, she's making the decisions on the bridge, and she's going to be NJP. Like,
even from a political standpoint, it's difficult to accept the idea that they thought that would stand. You know, an NJP sounds to me like you're just trying to get this over with and move forward. They had to know there was going to be more scrutiny than that. You know?
Right.
However, I do have to wonder a bit if she ended up going to court martial because she obviously entered into a plea deal. She'll likely be, I would assume, testifying against the commander of the vessel. So it sounds to me like they're after him, you know? And that's the reason why maybe they brought it in for a court martial was to put leverage on her to testify against her CO. But
if that's the case, that makes it even worse. Like, so wait, so who who thinks? And look, I don't care about any radar. I don't care about anybody's level of training. You know, we've been driving ships around the world for a few hundred years now, and we tend not to have them run into each other. And so for every one of these, so standing orders, you know, for instance, the factors that night, you're going to drive across a busy shipping lane, okay, a lot of ships in it. The CO tells you that he wants you to keep the speed at 20 to 22 knots. One, if you don't think that's safe, you know what you do? You wake him up.
You don't do it. Yeah.
You wake him up and you tell him, hey, sir, can I talk to you? Given the functioning of our radars, I don't think transiting at 20 to 22 knots is safe. Looking for your guidance. And you have a conversation about that. You know, next question.
When I was in the Marine Corps, I worked for good leaders and for bad leaders. But at no point did I ever think, this is a leader that I can't come to talk to him about our Marines' lives being in jeopardy. You know? And that's really what we're talking about there is, you know, abiding by lawful orders. When they say, you know, you need to abide all lawful orders, an unlawful order, an example could be one that's going to get sailors killed. You know? It's your responsibility as a leader to push back and say, we can't do this. you know, hey, sir, I don't think this is going to work. And he'll probably go, oh, yeah, you know, you're right. It's a lot better that we slow down a bit than it is that we end up on CNN tonight.
Yeah, and you know what? And those standing orders or those orders were probably written with some other conditions in mind. You know, for instance, if your radar is degraded, it's a pretty quick conversation. Hey, sir, the reason I'm doing this is because this radar is degraded, and the response is, got it. have we doubled the lookout, the physical lookout on the bridge? No, sir.
Instead, they didn't even have open comms to the people who were manning the radar stations in the belly of the ship.
Right.
You know, the combat control area of the ship. They weren't even staying in regular contact. It's like they had less visibility vice what they should have been doing, which was pursuing more.
So how does she go to NJP? And if the only reason to take her to court-martial is to get her to testify against him, first of all, she has a moral obligation. What is she going to do? She's got a moral obligation as an officer in the United States military to tell the truth about what happened. 7 sailors were killed. So it's important that she do that. And so I don't understand the plea deal. I don't know. They want him. And let me ask you this. He came out last week. His 2 attorneys say, hey, we'll waive our right. We'll go to court martial. You want to do this? We'll do this. He didn't do anything wrong. He was asleep. He had standing orders. He had people that had been trained and been to school. He expected them to follow his orders. They didn't. And you've already disparaged him with comments by leaders throughout the Navy. And so if you want to do this in public, we'll do it in public. What do you think the collective reaction at headquarters, United States Navy, was to that? Right.
Honestly, I'd be willing to bet that they're not sweating it. And the reason
why I think
this story, while interesting to us, isn't gleaning a lot of traction in the mainstream media.
Right.
You know?
No, you're right.
And I bet you what they think is ultimately everything's going to be hung on this guy because they're going to say it was a leadership climate issue, a command climate issue. This training problems and making poor decisions while he was asleep was all the result of him being a poor leader leading up to this incident occurring, that's what I'd imagine the case is going to be put up against him. It's going to be hard for him to argue against a qualitative statement like that. It's easy to do something quantitative. If there's numbers related, he can say, I said this, they did this, and that's that. But a qualitative thing, like bad leadership, it's nebulous. You know, it's hard to defend against. All you've got to do is convince, you know, the military leaders in the room, the jury of your peers, you just have to convince them that you were doing a poor job of leading. And that's tough to defend against if you've got a prosecutor. I think there's still a solid chance this ends up being laid on his feet.
Well, no, I mean, and the Navy has, and really, as the captain, right, everything that ship does is your responsibility. So I don't know how he escapes it. Here's what I think is interesting about all of this. You hear this constant chatter in articles written, the 100-hour work week, okay? Those of us who have deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan laugh at the 100-hour work week.
Agreed. Right?
That means you have 10 hours free a day while you're deployed. That's a joke. And Senator McCain is wrong as wrong can be when he's bitching about that. Number two, you know, well, we had systems that were degraded and we weren't completed training. No shit. That's how everybody deploys. You have leaders that are supposed to make sure that when you're doing things like transiting shipping lanes, that the right people are on the bridge when you're doing that. That the adults are in the area, and then you're doing OJT, which, oh, by the way, we've been doing for hundreds of years. He didn't get to go to school. It's all right. We're going to see. He'll be in the best school that he could be in. He'll be learning on his ship with good leaders that can teach him. That's called OJT. That's not a bad thing.
No, I disagree with you on this part.
That's okay.
I disagree with you here.
That's okay. You're young. I'll correct you. So anyway, so you can be school trained by those knobs in the schoolhouse, or you can do it OJT. We've been doing OJT forever. Okay, we've been going.
OJT only works if they're actually doing it, though.
Oh, no, that's a different issue, though. That's a different issue. And now we're getting to the crux of the issue. Okay, we've been doing OJT, and we've been going to war without every system that we have full up round forever.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But it's important to know these guys aren't going to an active combat zone. These guys are going to go sail through shipping lanes. There's no reason for them not to have gotten their full suite of training.
There could be. There could be schoolhouse reasons in terms of throughput. They could be forced to deploy and surged when they were supposed to go in for another ship that had a maintenance issue.
But none of those are problems without solutions. Those are all just logistical solutions, something that we need to address systemically. You know, when you see something happen over and over, like, you know, these aircraft mishaps being a great example, every time I write about another aircraft going down and I blame a lack of maintenance or a lack of training, I always get a comment saying, wait until the investigation comes out, you're jumping to conclusions. The investigation comes out, and yeah, it looks like we haven't thrown a wrench at that helicopter in 2 years, surprise, it fell out of the sky. When you see something happen over and over, you have to go, maybe there's a systemic issue in play.
Yeah, I don't.
You know, when we
I think the systemic issue is a cop-out.
So how do you explain the trend that goes across multiple commands, that goes across multiple incidents?
It's not a systemic issue, it's just a bunch of similar mistakes. In my opinion, aviation is a little different. I think that and I will grant you a little bit of a systemic mea culpa here. Congress failed the aviation community of the entire Department of Defense.
Yes.
By not funding it appropriately. So planes didn't get fixed. They don't have spare parts. Pilots didn't get training hours. They got a minimum amount of training hours to stay, quote-unquote, current. The difference, if you ask a pilot, between what is current, which is 5 to 6 hours a month, and what is proficient, which is about 20 to 25 hours a month, that's a huge difference, okay?
You're right, I agree.
That's a huge difference. And then all of a sudden something goes wrong in the aircraft, and then they're not good enough, and we're paying for that now. So in my opinion, all these different incidences that you see are a result. Still, some could be, you know, older aircraft and spare part issues, and you do have to wait for the investigation to find that. But there's other systemic issues, and this is my systemic mea culpa. You have inexperienced pilots that simply don't have enough reps, and when these things happen and you have probably 90 seconds to deal with it and you don't do it right, then you're screwed. And it's just
– And the more poorly you maintain the aircraft, the more likely those issues are going to arise, right. You know? And training is – it's important to note that training isn't only for, you know, the guy with the stick in his hand. When we're talking about training, we need our flight crews to be well-trained. We need the maintenance crews and the mechanics to be well-trained, you know? And now it's easier to quantify the lack of training that a pilot gets because we've got hours to look at,
right.
You know. But when I talk to my buddies that are Harrier mechanics, they're all working on airplanes that are older than them, you know. And they're responsible to make sure that these airplanes are safe, even though they don't always have parts to work with. They don't always have the appropriate tools. They don't always have the right training. I'm not saying that a mechanic screwed up and put an airplane in the ground. But I am saying that the more of these little allowances you make, the more likely an incident is to occur.
No,
you know, it's a lot of little variables that could lead to a terrible outcome.
No doubt. Yeah. And it's not that a mechanic can't put an aircraft in the ground, because they can. They can.
Absolutely.
But, I'm not an aviator. I do play one on the radio on occasion. But one of my gunnies is a sergeant major with HMM 167 or something like that. They used to be a 46 squadron. Now they're an Osprey squadron. And he and I were talking. I said, how do you like swinging with a wing? He said, it's different. He said, and they need strong leaders here. He said, so I'm glad I'm here. He said, let me tell you the biggest difference. Here, it's on every day. Every time an aircraft goes into the sky, there's the potential, you know, for somebody to get dead. In the grunts, we might do ranges a couple times a month, okay? And we're acutely aware of, you know, somebody could get dead today. That happens every day here. Every day you have to be accountable for the tools. Every day you have to be accountable for the maintenance checks. And he said, and so,
you know, it's true. One missing socket wrench will ground to fleet. You know, people don't realize that. Yeah. But all you need to do is lose your 10 mil, and every airplane on the runway can't leave anymore. Because for all they know, you left it in a jet inlet.
Right. Right.
You know.
So to take this back to the Navy, I see the aviation is different. And what leaders do is they manage these things. Okay, I know Hollings hasn't been to school. Who's my best helmsman? Okay, he's going to tutor Hollings. Okay? Hollings is going to be his butt boy for the next, you know, for all 2 weeks of this deployment. And so when we're done with this little trip we're going to take, Hollings is going to be, you know, he's going to at least be solid. The next deployment, because Hollings now can't go to school until then, he's going to get graduate level training at that. And so to me, I don't see the Navy issues as aviation issues. This is stuff that you deal with all the time. And so to me, this is a leadership issue in the Navy. This is not a schools issue. It's not a maintenance issue. It is a leadership issue. And that these are the things leaders are supposed to manage. And then you look at the McCain. He did not set the sea and anchor detail as he was advised by his OPSO and his XO, and that is the most experienced navigators, helmsmen, watch guys. They're the ones that when you go in and out of ports, when you transit heavy shipping lanes, he said no. He didn't put the ship in general quarters, which a lot of ships do when they go through the Malaccan Straits. They just drove this son of a bitch with lesser qualified people, and they turned in front of a ship.
I agree with you completely. I think that we're talking, it's a semantic argument between us at this point, because I think you're right. I just see that as a systemic issue. I think that our leaders are failing us, and so the question is, why are so many leaders failing in similar ways?
Yeah.
You know, and what that tells me is, either the leaders haven't been getting the appropriate training, or they're not thinking about things strategically or tactically the way that they ought to be thinking about their jobs. But when you see the same problem across multiple thresholds, I go, something somewhere is jacked up in this system.
Right.
Now, I agree with you. It might not necessarily be whether or not we got all these E3s through a school. You know, but I do think something in this process is screwed up sufficiently that we've got multiple leaders making the same bad choices. You know, and when I see that, I blame the leader. Don't get me wrong. You should know better. You're a career sailor. This isn't your first time on a ship. You know, it's not your first command. In both of these instances, you should know better. But I have to ask myself, why should they know better? At somewhere along the way, they should have been taught. They should have learned. They should have been briefed. Something. You know, at this point, it's on them.
Right.
But 10 years ago, it was on somebody else. And what I'd like to do is address both. I want to address the failures that they made.
How can you be in the business of ship driving and have a very junior Lieutenant JG on the bridge crossing a shipping lane and no other adult, you know, sitting there drinking a cup of coffee for a couple hours making sure this goes okay?
See, and I think that's where I'm coming from, is that I don't get that at all. I'm with you.
I don't understand.
How do you do that? So of you and I who are not in the business of driving boats.
But I've driven them.
Feel this, right?
I haven't driven them, but I served on the bridge of an aircraft carrier. I served in CIC on an aircraft carrier processing the surface plot. Okay, heading. And this is back when you used to have the guys who stood behind the plexiglass and wrote backwards. That was an MOS. They went to school to learn how to write backwards to become dyslexic.
I didn't know that, but that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was, I'll tell you, here's a quick leadership story. This kid would wear these bracelets. He was an OS, which was an operations specialist. And so I'm sitting in CIC. I'd be on the bridge when the captain of the ship was on the bridge, because when we got within the 50 miles of the coast of Iran, there was intelligence that the Iranians knew that the SEWIS system on the aircraft carrier didn't track anything that went slower than 120 knots. So they were going to fill Cessnas with ordnance and then fly it out and crash it into an aircraft carrier. So what do? We put 50 cals on the exterior of the ship, and we're all linked in by sound-powered headsets, and I stood on the bridge, and when the CO told me to shoot, we shot. And so when the CO, so I had a chance to watch them and then, and watch the whole thing. Then when he wasn't there, I went down to CIC. So one night I'm watching this kid and he has these, he's wearing these bracelets and he's wearing like three black gaskets, rubber bracelets or things around his wrist. And he's got a couple gold chains. And I'm watching him and I'm thinking, you know, everybody in this place sees what he's doing. And so I watched it for a night. The next night, you know, he's working, and I have my own little radar thing that I stare at, right? This is the round Navy radar thing, and you write with it on a grease pencil and then wipe your stuff off in white. Yeah, that's old. Look, hey, First Lieutenant Mac.
It sounds like the hunt to Red October. This is awesome.
Yeah, First Lieutenant McNamara, Executive Officer, Marine Detachment, USS Ranger. So I'm sitting there, and I said, hey, and I knew his name. I don't know his name now. And I said, can I ask you a question? And he said, yeah. I said, you know you're not supposed to wear those bracelets. Why are you wearing those? And he looks at me and he says, do you want me to take them off, sir? I said, you don't work for me. I'm just curious. You know, everybody in here sees what you, you know, sees you riding there. I said, you just do it to thumb your nose at them? And I, you know, and I had, you know, I knew where the kid lived and I knew, you know, because you're, you know, you're there with him. You talk to him. And he said, well, so, you know, I didn't think it was a big deal. And so he takes them off. And so one of them, and so the next day, one of the Lieutenant JG sees me and he says, hey, I heard you chewed OS, you know, Hollings out last night.
I said, I didn't chew anybody out. I just asked him.
Exactly. I said, you idiots don't know shit about leadership. First of all, I know Hollings. He's from, you know, he's from Atlanta, Georgia. He played football and basketball in high school. He's got a girlfriend that's trying to dump him right now. Okay. So I know him. I simply asked him a question. And when he asked me, do you want me to take him off? I said, look, if these guys don't care enough to tell you, then I'm not going to tell you. But I would tell you what, if you were a Marine, I said, there's no way in hell you'd be doing that. And he took him off. He took him off because that was the right thing to do. I said, but you guys got to learn that the leading is about caring about them, getting to know them, having them respect you, and then they would never do that stuff. Oh, you guys are such assholes, blah, 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 blah. I said, yeah, we are. So I watched the surface plot on a nightly basis. And when your visibility's degraded or your radar's degraded, guess what you do? You put more people on the exterior of the ship. So when you're transiting.
To me, that's a common sense solution.
When you're transiting,
you know?
Yeah. Because even if your radar's working, it can go down. And when it goes down, then what do you do? Go to the backup. Okay, what happens if the backup's not functioning? Because that happens.
I mean, boats weren't invented after radar, you know?
So I don't get it.
We've been driving boats for a lot longer than we've been manning radar streetlights.
I don't get it. And then you go through the accidents, Alex, and then nobody, you know you're going to hit, right? It's not like a car accident where you have 3 seconds. You know that you're...
No, you've got minutes. 15 minutes. So they were going, we're going to hit this boat.
And nobody hits the collision...
And they notified nobody in the taxi.
Yeah, nobody hits the collision alarm or since... If they would have hit the collision alarm 60 seconds before it happened, in either case, none of those guys would have been dead. They would have sat up quickly and noticed within 5 seconds, there's no, this is a drill. General quarters. When you don't hear that, you know the ship's going to general quarters immediately. And that sends a jolt of electricity right through your ass. You grab your boots, you grab your pants, and you run. And that's how you leave. And none of those guys would have been dead. And that's the level of incompetence.
So how in what world is it that the person whose sole responsibility in that incident is to sound that alarm, is to give people that forewarning, how does that person get an NJP?
Explain
you know?
It to me, man.
The person
man.
That you place the responsibility
you're,
on. No.
You're a writer.
But once
you're
it's a foregone conclusion that we're going
to
hit.
You're supposed to have answers. Have an answer, man. You're a writer. You're not only a writer, you're a senior writer at SoftRep. Explain that to me.
See, that's the difference, though. That doesn't mean that I can necessarily explain what an idiot is an idiot. Or God's honest truth. Maybe this is a very capable sailor. Maybe she, I don't have her name in front of me, but maybe she's a capable sailor under most circumstances. She folds under pressure.
Copic.
Maybe her that's
name,
the case. Whatever it is,
Lieutenant.
It's a legitimate failure on her part. She got charged with one, she pled guilty to Article 92. one charge of Article 92 for 7 deaths. And for a series of mistakes and errors, judgment errors, ethical errors that she made along the way. And I really think it's because the Navy's after, what's his name, Bryson? Is that the commander of the boat? Benson. The Navy's after Benson's head. You know, and it concerns me that we're going to pin all of this on one guy when it seems to me like this is a problem that's widespread. You know, the same type of bad leadership that would lead her to not hit the collision alarm, that would lead her to not be in constant contact with the CIC, sounds to me like the same kind of bad leadership that would have him, you know, tell her maintain the speed even in unsafe conditions, whether or not he can.
No,
you know, that's
you're talking
the same
about,
problem.
Right, you're talking about a
at
trend.
Different levels of leadership.
You're talking about a trend. A whole bunch of different data points that point to a trend of bad leadership. No doubt.
Yeah, I agree.
Have you seen this article? There's been 4 amphib COs relieved in the last 12 months in San Diego.
I haven't seen that. That's crazy.
Isn't it?
Now, were they all relieved for the same incident? Were they all involved in something?
Nope. All different incident. The latest was last week. The Navy fired the skipper of the Harper's Ferry. Her name is Commander Tammy Sue Royal. After superiors lost confidence in her ability to effectively lead sailors carry out her duties, she was fired by Rear Admiral Cedric Pringle, commander of Expeditionary Strike Group 3. The 4th senior San Diego-based amphibious warfare leader to be relieved of duty over the past year.
Does that make you wonder if they're cracking down on readiness following last year's embarrassing incidents? You know, when I was in the Marine Corps at the regimental level, one of the big pushes all the time was holding COs responsible for the level of readiness of the Marines,
right.
You know, which we quantify through training, PT, medical evaluations, dental. You know, there's a whole bunch of wickets you need to hit in order to be an effective warfighter, according to a piece of paper, right? It sounds to me like, without knowing anything about these incidents, maybe they were all part of a big sex dungeon cult. But without knowing that, that sounds to me a lot like
what
they're cracking down on leaders for a lack of readiness within their sailors. You know.
All right. We'll see. No, it's. I will tell you what. It's a. And I'm trying to understand this. I'm still trying to understand how you don't have somebody on the exterior of the ship watching. I don't understand that.
So, you know, when I was, I must have been 25, 26 years old, my brother's got this 40-foot yacht that's a lake boat. You know, it's a shallow drift boat. You know, it's probably only in the water 2 feet, even though it's really long. And we had this crazy idea to drive it from Connecticut, where he lived, down to the shore in the south so that it could be shipped to Georgia, where we live now. We made it to Atlantic City before we hit a sand bar doing about 30 miles per hour and really messed up the boat. However, once it was done, once we finally got off that sandbar, we had one good prop left that vibrated like a bastard just to run. But we were able to get the boat up to about 5 miles per hour to try to get it back into Atlantic City, into a pier, so that we could tie up for a storm that was coming. We had the two guys that weren't driving the boat on the bow of the boat holding hand flashlights, just looking to make sure that we didn't hit anything in the water on a 40-foot boat, which is significantly smaller than an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer. You know, but it was so legitimately a threat to us on that little dinky boat that we put both of us up on the bow with flashlights to be safe. How do you not do that in a crowded shipping lane when your radar is compromised, when you don't have high visibility because it's nighttime? I don't understand, as we know that, us, the idiots that were willing to crash into a sandbar doing 35, you know, the idiots who thought that you could take a lake boat in the ocean, if we knew to do it, how does the Navy not?
Yeah, I don't know. Are we just too stupid? You don't understand how the Navy works. The modern Navy works. It doesn't work like that anymore. Well, and my response would be, I ran a combat operations center. Right? We have when the wind moves our dishes, and we lose our data connection, we lose phones, we lose our phones, we lose all data link, email, chat, all that. We become a World War II operations center. That's what we do.
And especially because when you lose comm, it takes a while to get it back. When those satellites are, I used to work in the COC also, and if the satellites go down, you're looking at hours, minimum.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it depends if you have to shut down your servers. If you don't have to shut down your servers, you're waiting for the wind to die down and the dust to go away because all that degrades the signal and you don't get it. If you have to shut down the servers, you're talking about 4 hours to bring those servers back up online. 4 hours.
We were fortunate enough. We had a guy from General Dynamics deployed with us whose job was just to maintain our servers. You know, so we had a... We had an expert right there on site with us. It was still a nightmare, you know?
Right. Let's switch gears. No, I'm fascinated because this is it a cultural problem? Because the Navy has sat out the last, 17 years of combat. They've been kind of tooling around, doing their own thing. They're more focused on sexual assault, sexual harassment, the social issues that involve the Navy, manpower, all of that. They're more focused on all that than they are on
operations. Strong feelings about that. That's why we don't have anti-ship missiles we can field. This is why we're not prepared for near-peer combat with other naval power. China is fielding destroyers every bit as capable as our Arleigh Burke-class destroyers. We're still pushing out the LCSs that don't work and don't have guns. Our new destroyer doesn't have a main gun. You know, the USS Gerald R. Ford is broken down. We're not emphasizing the Navy the way that we need to be emphasizing it because it legitimately is our force projection around the globe. The Navy is that first line of defense. It needs to be that first line of defense. It stabilizes shipping lanes. It stabilizes the global economy. The Navy is not just about winning a war. The Navy is about preventing them with a presence. And they're doing a poor job of it right now.
And I'll tell you what. When you look at the Navy, they are the event relative to the Chinese. Because I'm not exactly sure where we fight a land war against China. The Korean Peninsula, maybe? And I'll
tell you the reason why we'd avoid it. China has got a ton of military assets within their country, but they have very little logistical footprint to move those assets around. Chinese troops use public trains to relocate within China. They don't have the vehicles to move the equipment they would need to go invade something with like a significant force. I would think that if we went to war with China, we'd fight it in the water because we wouldn't want to fight it on the ground.
Neither one of us could get there because if we tried to move a large amphibious force against the Chinese,
their anti-ship missiles would have a field day with us.
Yeah. So where would we fight? Would we fight a proxy war against them in Africa in some way, shape, or form? I don't know. So
that sounds more feasible to me.
So what you're going to see you're going to see more naval. You're going to see the United States Navy and the Chinese Navy, kind of getting each other's faces. And in power projection contest, and you're going to see that?
Absolutely. We're already seeing it. China has got, they have the Liana, which is a Soviet-era aircraft carrier. It's a sister ship to Russia's broken-down Admiral whatchamacallit. But they've just built their Type 001 carrier. They're already field-testing one of them. They've got another one in production. China's going to have three carriers within the next few years, with two more already under construction. They've fielded 20 new vessels in the past 18 months. Destroyers, one carrier, a number of submarines. They also just came out with a new submarine propulsion system that, I kid you not, is very similar to that Whisper Drive from the Hunt from Red October, like we're talking about.
Right.
It uses electromagnets to propel the ship through the water with very few moving parts, so it's very difficult to detect. China is doubling down on having a force projection presence throughout the South China Sea at first. That's why we're seeing nuclear bombers on man-made islands. But they want to have a blue water navy. They want to force project the way America does. They want to become the next diplomatic power.
And if
we don't get our shit together, don't get me wrong, 355 ship navy Trump's talking about sounds great. But if they're not the right cross-section of ships, if they're not being managed properly, if we're not using what we've got effectively, it doesn't matter.
All right. We need to switch gears. We need to do an old man fitness update. So give me what are you writing about relative to old man fitness?
Well, this week's OMF just went up last night, and I went back to debunking some fitness myths because there's enough of them to write about this for the rest of my life, man. But the big ones I focused on this week are body mass index, you know, BMI. It's similar to the Marine Corps tape method, but even less accurate, even less good a measurement of your health or fitness. But doctors use it, insurance companies use it, people tend to use it to gauge their fitness, and it's bullshit. BMI is utter bullshit. It's a simple math equation that goes off of your height and your weight. It doesn't take into account muscle density. It doesn't take into account bone density. According to my BMI, I am on the topmost scale of morbidly obese, 6 foot, 250 pounds. The BMI doesn't ask how much I bench press. It doesn't ask what my waist measurement is. You know, I've got a 34-inch waist. It doesn't matter. I weigh 250 pounds. You know, but people, your insurance companies, my life insurance charges me extra because of my BMI. You know, so we put a lot of stock in this idea. It was invented by a mathematician 200 years ago who at the time said BMI is a poor measurement of a person's health. It was intended to be used as a gross average for government policies.
Well, how come we haven't refined it to make it something good? I mean, why hasn't some really smart, medically and technically savvy fat person who's been impacted by this gone and developed another tool that said this is more accurate? Why do we use that tool?
Oh, we have. We've got a bunch of these tools. Even, believe it or not, the tape method, which is horribly inaccurate, is more accurate than BMI. The pinch, I don't know if you've ever gone and had your body fat checked with a caliper, but what they do is they tell you not to work out for a day or two, and then they'll pinch the loose skin on your stomach, and the more places that the more data sets they collect, the more accurate ultimately it'll be. The most accurate way to determine your body fat percentage is actually a water displacement test where they put you in a tank and they see how much fluid is displaced by your body, and they use that to make assessments of your body composition, you know, a bone structure, muscle density, and fat. The thing is that all that stuff's complicated and costs some money. You know, even if you want to use the caliper method, you got to buy a caliper. It's like $20. If you want to do that, institute that across the Marine Corps, you'd have to buy a ton of them. Now we're talking millions of dollars. Instead, the Marine Corps uses the tape because it's cheap and it's effective-ish. BMI is even less effective, but it's very simple. It's very cost-effective. It's very easy to manage. You just get two numbers, plug it into a thing, and you got it. And that's all you need to do. To save money by exercising it, you use BMI, but you also make more money by using BMI because it was somebody like me, you get to charge me 30% higher insurance premiums because of my weight, because my BMI weighs me as obese.
So it's part of
why would you want to stop doing that?
It's part of the scam? Come on.
It absolutely is. Absolutely is.
You're selling me the black helicopter this early on a Monday morning?
I'm telling you, it's not a black helicopter. It's a white one with the brand name painted across the side. It flies over your house every day, and we just like to pretend that they're not out to get us. We're scared of the black ones. Those aren't the ones to worry about, man. The one that says Google on the side is the one collecting your information.
Are you kidding me? Well, no. Why would Google need to collect any more? They know everything I do.
Yeah, but you're still doing stuff. You're not done, so neither are they. You know?
Google, man. But George Orwell couldn't even conceive of how much Google knows about you.
It's true. You know, I have an Alexa in my house. You know, I ask it all the time to buy me new diapers and baby formula because it's always listening. You know, have you seen that meme floating around the internet where it's like we used to worry about Russia bugging us, but now we just put the bugs in ourselves?
No, I haven't.
Like, we're like, hey, bug, can you please order more baby formula?
And it does?
Oh, absolutely, man. I get most of my baby stuff from the little black hockey puck that's sitting on my desk right now. I just tell it to order me more baby formula, and more shows up tomorrow. And it looks fantastic. But the trade-off is that I have no privacy.
You think? Wow. It's scary.
Digressing. But remember, this all comes back from BMI is bullshit. Don't trust anybody who tells you that your BMI is bad. You may well be a fat ass. You know, that's feasible. but there's better ways to determine it. So don't judge your fitness based on your BMI, because it's really, really inaccurate. The next one that I addressed was my favorite one, and it's when people tell me that they're overweight because of their genetics. Your genes may not do you any favors, but they're not keeping you fat. You know, there was a recent study that was published in a peer-reviewed medical journal that says exactly the same thing. It effectively says that your genes could have a big effect on your appetite, on your feelings of satiation, or telling you when you think you're full, but it's still the shit you're eating that's making you fat. But, you know, they did a study across, I think it was 9,000 participants, you know, ranging on with a different variety of the commonly associated fat genes, the genes that tend to make you more overweight, and people who qualitatively qualify as having a genetic predisposition for overweight, for being overweight. And what they found is that diet worked pretty much the same for people who had that genetic predisposition and people who didn't. Exercise worked about the same for people with the disposition and those who didn't. Even these crash diets that are an unhealthy way to lose weight also worked about the same for people with a genetic predisposition to being overweight and those who didn't. So what that tells us is that that genetic predisposition made it easier for you to make those decisions to get fat. But they're not stopping you from getting in shape. You know, you can't blame your genes forever. Eventually, your decision, the shit you keep shoveling into your mouth. It's basic math, calories in versus calories out, right? So now that there's studies to actually back up this idea, now every time somebody can tell me, oh, no, it's my genetics that's making me fat, I can go, no, it's the hamburgers and the cookies. It's the fat pills that are making you fat. Your genetics aren't helping you, but you've got to overcome that. So that's overwhelming need to justify our own action.
Okay, so the bottom line is we're all affected by genetics, period. Okay,
new paragraph. To one extent or another, absolutely.
Period, new paragraph. But within the groundwork that your genetics lay, you make a whole lot of decisions and impact your own health.
Absolutely. Well, a great example could be you may be genetically predisposed to having a larger appetite than your body needs, right? So when that happens, you don't feel full, you don't feel satiated until you've already consumed more calories than you needed to consume. And as a result, your whole life you've been overweight. And I can't fault you for being 7 years old and not knowing better. I can't fault you for being 20 and not knowing better. But once you look at yourself in the mirror as an adult and you go, well, shit, I'm fat. It's time for you to start making conscious decisions instead of just blaming that genetic bias. It's a little bit harder for me to stop eating because I'm not getting the signals that I'm full, so I'm just going to be fat. Isn't an excuse. If you want to be fat, you know, by all means. But if you don't want to be fat, stop blaming mom and dad. You know, this is on you.
All right, well, that's harsh. Okay, so give me the next fallacy that you wrote about, and then we got to talk about your latest column. So one other fat fallacy that you've or fitness fallacy that you've taken on.
All right, this one comes with a little bit of a nuance to it, but skipping meals and even intermittent fasting is not a very effective means of losing weight. You will definitely lose weight. You definitely can lose weight through intermittent fasting. But studies are showing that people who choose to skip meals because they want to skip those calories tend to binge eat on the other end. I didn't eat breakfast, so I'm going to have a big lunch. You know, I haven't eaten yet today, so I'm going to get 2 Baconators. Further, people who follow intermittent fasting as a practice have a much higher recidivism rate. They drop off the diet sooner, and they bounce back harder than those that would follow just a traditional calorie-restricted diet, you know, like portion management, where you just go, maybe I'll get a little bit less each meal. Those people who tend to skip meals or who will be like, I'm not eating until 8 o'clock every night, you can genuinely lose weight that way, but you have a much higher chance of failing and failing spectacularly, of bouncing back further into the fat realm than you did before.
Okay, so what?
So it can be effective for some. It's not a good manageable diet method.
What works then? What historically works?
It's, and you already need to answer to this one, man. It's just basic math. It's calories in versus calories burned in your day is really what's going to determine your body fat percentage. Now, there are some things, like, for instance, if you eat a bunch of carbohydrates before bed, a lot of people will tell you that's a surefire way to get fat. That's not really a surefire way to get fat if your overall calorie intake for the day was still, a net deficiency. If you burned 3,000 calories today and only ate 2,500, it doesn't matter that much that you ate 500 of them before bed. You know, I mean, the basic arithmetic of it tells us that there isn't, you know, conservation of matter. They can't out of if it isn't in there. You know, so people want to make this much more complicated than it is. They want to tell you you have to eat before a certain time of day, which, don't get me wrong, can make you feel better to do. You know, they want to tell you intermittent fasting is the answer, or maybe eating like a caveman. What it really comes down to is just a healthy balance of things, proportion control, and exercise. You know, people were in good shape and not dying of diabetes for a long time before we invented the Atkins diet. You know, for a long time before we decided to go paleo. Right? What you need to do is just be mindful about what you put in your body. And what a lot of these diets do is they help make it easier because you don't have to think about it. You know, I got this Atkins bar. If that's your method, that's your method. But basically, it's just math, man. It's like I ate 3 cheeseburgers today, but I only burned 2 cheeseburgers today, so now my ass is made out of that extra cheeseburger. You know? And the more complicated, you can make it very complicated when you're a figure competitor, or Lance Armstrong, or an Olympian. But for a guy like me that's just trying to avoid buying new pants, it's simple math, man. You know, it's not nearly as complicated as marketing will tell you.
You sound like a physician now. You sound like old school, this is how you do it, right? Portion control, exercise, consistency.
I know, nobody loves that answer.
I know.
People hate that answer,
everybody,
man.
Hates it. Everybody like, click, 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 this guy's an ass. I don't need to listen to this.
This guy's an asshole.
Yeah, I know, I don't need to listen
to this. I want to know I could do 3 sit-ups and take a pill and be jacked, you know?
Or better yet, go to Sauna Bella. Oh, my God. Yeah, go have them, like, freeze your fat away and see how that looks.
Oh, God.
It looks, if you've ever seen anybody who's had it done, it doesn't all come off smooth. It comes off lumpy and irregular, and then that's how your body is. The good thing about doing it naturally, as hard as it is your body has its own intricate system of pulling fat out, and it looks normal. When you do that, you destroy your body.
You know, and that speaks to another really common thing, the idea of spot reductions. You don't get to pick where your body will pull fat from first.
Answer me this. I need to work on, like, this is the thing you'll hear women say. My arms are getting flabby, so I need to, like, do arm exercises. Response: you can't cure that. You can firm up the muscle underneath the fat, okay, but you can't target fat loss, okay?
It doesn't work. You cannot target fat loss. You're 100% right.
Why do you say that? Why do you say that to me? I'm just trying to. All I'm trying to say is that, you know, when you lose fat, you lose it from all over your body, okay? And in an order that you can't target fat loss. And then it's just like,
you know, when I was working as a trainer, the most common thing
I don't want to talk about
from females was that their boobs would go away. You know, they're working hard, they're losing weight, and a lot of women, they would lose their boobs. Their gut would stay, their butt would stay, their thighs would stay the same. Their boobs would go first, and they would be mad at me. I'm training them wrong.
Of course.
You know? But that's not the way your body works. Your body decides where it's going to burn fat first, the same way it decides where it's going to build fat first. Just so happens, I'm built in a way that as I gain weight, I look increasingly pregnant. You know, like, my shoulders will stay the same, my jawline stays the same, and I just look like I'm going from the first semester to the second.
Nice.
You know, if I could change that, I would. I can't change that. I got to work with it.
All right. We got about 5 minutes. What are you writing on this week? Alex Hollings, my guest. He is SoftRep, senior writer there. You can find his work at softrep.com. He'll be on the front page in the search column. In the search box, put in Alex Hollings, Hollings.
You got it.
and you'll find all his work. He does great stuff, and joins us here every couple of weeks. No, I mean, it's good stuff. I read it. What are you working on now?
Well, I've got a column that just went up earlier that's going to raise a lot of eyebrows. People will be mad, but it's about, you know, the shooting that took place in Santa Fe on Friday.
Yeah.
And how all of the proposals that we had, honestly, from the left and from the right to a large extent, that after the Parkland shootings, none of those would have affected the Santa Fe shooting in any way. None of them would have stopped this shooting from going on. The weapons that he used...
Okay, let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question. So... should we not be talking about stopping these? I mean, we can try to stop them. Should we talk about the reality is, we'll try to stop them, but really what you have to do is you have to be able to limit them once they start. Is that the realistic goal? We'll try to stop them.
Well, I think that it certainly is. The problem is, you know, putting something like that into practice while still maintaining that tentative grip that we maintain on our freedoms. You know, people like to think that our freedoms aren't at risk. Our freedoms are always, try to open a lemonade stand. Our freedoms are always at risk. We have to walk this balance, you know. And what we need to do is we need to find ways to step in when someone's going down this road. We need to find ways to limit their ability to access a firearm. We need to find ways to identify threats before they come. To make schools a less susceptible target, well, what I think we need to do is we need to find 50 solutions, because this problem isn't a problem. It's 50 problems, you know?
Right.
And that's why an assault weapons ban doesn't solve it.
Right.
That's why even magazine restrictions wouldn't have affected this shooting. He used a shotgun and a revolver.
Right.
Even if you banned all semi-automatic weapons,
right,
he still would have killed those 10 people.
Right.
You know, but there were two armed, talented, skilled, trained resource officers on site engaged with the shooter. It was still a 15-minute firefight, because the reality of the firefight is that training isn't armor. Training doesn't make you bulletproof. You know, a 17-year-old kid with a shotgun can still keep two trained officers at bay, you know, for 15 minutes, because you still need to not get shot. You know, one of the intel guys that I work with has this saying that really pisses people off, but it's accurate. Most of the really highly trained Navy SEALs, Rangers, Green Berets that we've lost, you know, MARSOC guys that we've lost in the fight, were killed by just some dude with an AK that barely knew how to use it.
Right.
You know, because training doesn't make you bulletproof, it just makes you more capable.
Right.
You know, bad things still happen. So I think that those resource officers, that they were there where they needed to be. I'm a big believer in resource officers.
Right.
I think magazine restrictions wouldn't have helped. An automatic weapons restriction wouldn't help. Semi-automatic restrictions wouldn't help. So what we need to do is we need to find a whole litany of solutions for a whole litany of problems. But we as a people really want something that we can consolidate into a meme. We want to say it's the NRA that's doing this. Or we want to say it's Hillary Clinton. We want to say it's one bad guy with one bad intent. The reality is that there's a million problems at play here. And we really need to engage with them honestly together. And that's the tough part. That's what's slowing our country down, is that we're in fortified positions and we're not willing to have a conversation. You know, I'm just as guilty as anybody because I love my guns. But, we need to be willing to have a discourse with one another, even with if what the other side is saying is offensive to my sensibilities.
Okay. I'm going to find some solutions. I'm going to a meeting tonight. So in 60 seconds, tell me what I should be advocating.
Honestly, man, that's tough. I would argue what you need to be advocating is a bipartisan solution to this. What you need to be advocating is putting our heads together. I don't have the answer, but I feel like we could come up with the answers, multiple answers, if we were willing to work together. But I don't think any one guy is going to have the solution.
You're selling me the little engine that could. What problem am I at? Give me the number one problem I have to solve then.
But that's what I'm saying. That mentality is the problem. The number one problem we need to solve is that mentality.
Well, tell
that there's
me.
One thing
okay,
I can
so
go
I'm
and
willing,
do.
I'm willing.
There's one thing
no, no, no.
That
I'm not.
Right that
I'm not
saying.
No. I'm not saying that there's one thing. I'm saying that as we prioritize these things, because here's what I'll tell you what I think. Look, we can have this discussion, okay? But the first thing that we need to do is we need to get armed officers in every school. And then we can we can have our discussion, because I'm not sure that you can ever prevent this stuff. Right?
I hate to say it, but I agree with that as well.
And it's a sad conclusion. The best we can do is limit the damage through resource officers that are experienced, that are willing to go challenge a shooter immediately and to limit the damage. Once you do that,
in a country with 350 million people, statistically speaking, it's crazy that crazy things don't happen.
Right. No, you're right. And so to me, and then we can study it, but the most cruel fate that happens in combat is for people that cause the death of others by virtue of their own negligence or inaction. There is no forgiveness for that. And I think I'm going to stand up and say this tonight. So you who have a voice in this decision, if you don't do something, and God forbid that something bad happens at a school district or this school, there is nobody that will lift the burden that you will go to your grave with. It will destroy your life. So I would encourage you, we can have this, we can put together a working group. We can study the hell out of it. And I heard we need to have one entrance in most schools. Well, how do you do that? And then the debate went to, well, do you stagger the start times? Well, what happens if I have three kids that go to the school? I got to make three trips, 30 minutes apart, to drop my kids off. Well, we have to allow for that. How do we do that? And so we have to work through those kind of issues and problems after you.
Absolutely, we have to work through it logistically.
Right after we provide security for our kids, and if you don't,
I think you raise a great point. I think the one thing, if I were allowed to put my money into just one endeavor, it would be fortifying our schools to an extent. It would make them a less susceptible target to this type of violence. There are plenty of target-rich environments in America. You know, our schools are among the least well-defended. And I do think that finding some way, whether it's restricting the entrances, adding more resource officers, you know, metal detectors, whatever it may need to be, we need to do something that makes a school not look like such an easy target.
Right.
You know,
well,
if you're going to be a crazy person and you want to kill a bunch of people, we need to make schools not the best case scenario for you.
Alex Hollings, can cram more conversation into 60 minutes than any human being I know.
Despite the fact that my phone's all screwing up, man, I'll have this resolved before we talk next time, I promise.
No. First of all, thank you for doing this. Tell everybody where they find your work.
Hey, you guys can find me on StopRep.com. If you're looking for just me, it's StopRep.com/authors/Alex Hollings, but there's a lot of great content on the site. On Facebook, you can find me at Facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter. And on Twitter, you can find me at AlexHollings52.
There you have it. All right. Good luck. Thank you for the visit.
Hey, always a pleasure, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
There you have it. Alex Hollings here on a Monday. Mike Musselman joins us next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.